Hey, folks. Welcome to According to Sam. This is episode 196. And thank you guys for watching. Hope you've had a good week so far. We're going to get back into talking about Ukraine in this podcast. I just have a little more to share with you guys about Ukraine. And, you know, the reason that I'm explaining and going into this detail about Ukraine and have been for the past few weeks is because I understand history, and I know I watched how we basically sleepwalked after we were stunned by the 9/11 attacks. We didn't go into Iraq immediately. Went to Afghanistan immediately, but we didn't go into Iraq immediately. And I watched the slow build up to that foreign policy disaster, that war that cost us, if you include contractors, 10,000 American lives, they estimate 1 million Iraqis, cost us $5 trillion. That disaster didn't just spring up. It was a slow move towards that war. And I understand how we got bogged down in Vietnam in the 1960s, that it was a slow move to that long, costly war. Even World War II. If you understand World War II and our involvement, the war had been going on for a while before we got involved in World War II. Most Americans did not want us to get involved in World War II until after Pearl Harbor. So I understand how these things happen, and I sense Ukraine that if we're not careful, that we could sleepwalk our way into a very, very serious conflict with Russia, a conflict that doesn't need to happen, that that shouldn't have happened, as you're going to see today. And the most important tool in war is the war propaganda, because the reason that the Vietnam War, people don't really understand this, but that's why they went to a all-volunteer army, because they knew that they would not be able to execute the war and get the public approval of the war if anybody's children could be drafted to go out to the war. So they went to an all-volunteer army, and most of the people who were protesting the war in Vietnam were protesting because they didn't want their kids to get drafted, or their kids had gotten drafted and gotten killed. So they made it an all-volunteer army, and a fraction of the population has been fighting all of these wars over the last 20 years. A small minority, while the rest of Americans have just been living it up like there's no war going on at all. Very, uninterested, very, just, I don't know, apathetic, could care less about the wars because they don't have to fight it. And now we're having huge recruitment problems in the all-volunteer army. And the draft, bringing back the draft, is on the table, absolutely on the table, especially if we get into a major conflict with Russia. It's stupid. That's why I'm speaking out against it. That's why I've been going into this detail about the war in Ukraine. And we have serious problems here at home. Let's start here at home. What's going on here in the United States of America right now And then we'll go and get into Ukraine. But what is happening in the United States of America right now? Well, this is happening. This is your debt. We hit $34 trillion in our national debt in early January. And if you remember, just last week, we went over this chart, how fast we're adding $1 trillion to the national debt. And the guy who posted this chart said every 90 to 120 days. And just as he said, we hit $34 trillion in January, early January. Here we are in March. We're basically $400 billion away from $35 trillion, which will probably hit within the 90 to 120 day mark. This is your border. This happened in El Paso yesterday. That's your border. Border people, check this out. If you haven't seen it, everyone's seen it. That's your border. Right, so that's your border. This is your debt. This is your border. And this is your Congress today. They passed a spending package worth $1.2 trillion. It doesn't even include all 14 appropriations. Now, if you remember, we're already almost in May. Last May, Kevin McCarthy, who was then the Speaker of the House, went into the Oval Office with just he and Joe Biden, and Joe Biden took him to the woodshed on a budget deal that was supposed to get all 14 appropriations done before the end of the fiscal year, the government's fiscal year, which is October, is when and so this new spending bill goes until October as well. So the one they did last May with Kevin McCarthy went until October, and they were supposed to get all 14 appropriations. There was also a provision in that deal that Kevin McCarthy made that if they didn't get all 14 appropriations done by the end of the fiscal year, that there would be a 1% cut in the discretionary programs, the social programs, and a 1% cut to the military. So that never went into effect because Kevin McCarthy was vacated. And then Speaker Johnson comes in and he does a continuing resolution, a CR. And then they did, I think they maybe did another CR, and then the clock was ticking this time. So they just did a deal for $1.2 trillion, doesn't include the military, doesn't include Homeland Security. They talk about it all here in this clip. Take a listen.
Some breaking news on Capitol Hill. The House has just passed that $1.2 trillion spending bill, a key vote as lawmakers race to avoid a partial government shutdown. The package keeps about three-fourths of the federal government operating through September. The bill now goes to the Senate, which has not yet scheduled a vote, and then it would head to President Biden. But several key agencies will have to suspend non-essential operations unless both the House and the Senate approve this 1,000-page bill, and President Biden signs it by
pages.
Midnight. The affected agencies include the Pentagon and the Department of Homeland Security. Although the measure had bipartisan support, members of the far-right Freedom Caucus blasted the measure during a floor debate this morning and tried to keep it from advancing to the Senate. But as we know now, it will, in fact, advance. Congressional correspondent Nathaniel Reed on Capitol Hill. Political correspondent Stephanie Liebergen is at the White House. Nate, your reaction to this?
Yeah, this got through by the skin of its teeth. This was an incredibly narrow margin. It might sound like a wide margin given that roughly 280 supporters voted in favor of this, 132 voted against it. That sounds like a wide margin, but they needed two-thirds support for this bill to pass.
So more, look here. So more Republicans voted against this than voted for it. So Speaker Johnson got this deal done with more Democrats votes. So he did it with the Democrats. And this is a huge problem because this was the election that we had last year, the House elections. And I don't know if you can see this. Let me expand this because I want you to see this. Nope, I can't. Anyway. This was the popular vote in the race for the House of Representatives, and Republicans won the popular vote by 3 million votes in the House of Representatives. We just learned that Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin is retiring. That's going to give Republicans a one-seat majority in the House of Representatives. And they won the popular vote for the House of Representatives by 3 million votes. So there's no wonder that, I mean, Johnson's in a position where he has to get these Democrats on board because the members of the Freedom Caucus were, and it wasn't only the members of the Freedom Caucus. Like, I mean, you already have 146 nays here. I mean, most of the people who voted against it were Republicans. So it's not just the Freedom Caucus. But so why did these Republicans have such a big problem with this spending package? Well, just as Kevin McCarthy there was a motion for him to vacate after he got taken to the woodshed by Joe Biden last May. Now Marjorie Taylor Greene has entered a motion for Speaker Johnson to vacate now because of this deal on this budget. And she explains why so many Republicans were against this bill. Take a listen.
We have some breaking news now on Capitol Hill. That is Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has officially filed a motion to vacate the speaker. There's a one-member motion to vacate that would seek to oust current House Speaker Mike Johnson. Let's listen in as she explains her rationale.
All week long, do not break the 72-hour rule. He heard from all of us. He heard from all of us all week long. Allow us to introduce amendments. Allow us to do our jobs. Allow us to represent the districts that voted for us and sent us here. We want a secure border. And the Senate proposal of legalizing 5,000 people coming across the border every day is not securing the border. And this is giving up every point of leverage we have. Also, forcing Republicans to vote on full-term abortion funding in order to fund our military is a complete betrayal of all of our values. And our voters don't want us to be doing that.
What is the process of finding this?
That's just a little bit of the rationale. I don't have time to play. I wish I had the clip from Chip Roy set up because what Johnson could have done was just do another continuing resolution until May. And then that provision would have kicked in that I was just telling you about where there would have been a 1% cut in social programs and in military programs. That's part of the provision that McCarthy had made last May. People, so this is your debt. This is your border. That's your border. And then this is Stanny Hoyer, Democrat, Senator Stanny Hoyer, on the floor of the Senate this week, and this is his concern. Take a listen.
Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to advise and extend my remarks. Time is wasting. Time is running out. We are sleeping while Ukraine is burning. The victim of an international criminal. Mr. Speaker, I rise today, as I have too many times before, just 72 hours before members return to their districts for weeks despite failing to secure aid for our allies in Ukraine and Israel. The men and women of Ukraine on the front lines will not sleep for those 2 weeks. This past weekend, Vladimir Putin reminded the world that he isn't going anywhere. He celebrated victory, in quotes, in Russia's presidential election, imposing his power until at least 2030. Mr. Speaker, Putin knew that there was only one possible outcome of that election. He would like the world to think the Russian victory in Ukraine is inevitable as well. Every day, however, Mr. Speaker, the brave men and women of Ukraine prove him wrong. Our NATO allies who continue to supply Ukraine with vital military assistance prove him wrong. Now, this House, this week, in the next 72 hours, needs to stand up and give Ukraine the aid they desperately need.
Just wow. Just wow. It's all you could say. It's all you could say is that this is our debt. This is our border. This is our budget. $1.2 trillion. That's not even, that just goes until September. We got huge issues in this country, people. Huge issues. And this guy's talking about Ukraine? He's talking about us funding and sending more money to Ukraine? Why isn't he calling for peace in Ukraine? What's going on here? This is crazy, man. So let's get back into Ukraine since that's our priority. That's why I started, if you guys remember, the very first podcast that I did talking about Ukraine, it's the podcast is titled Priorities. Ukraine is their priority. You are not their priority. Your border is not their priority. Your debt is not their priority. Your the inflation that comes from that debt and the higher prices that you're spending at the grocery store, on fuel. They don't care about that. Their priority is Ukraine. So let's get back into talking about Ukraine. So in the last podcast on Monday, we were looking at the peace plan, the peace proposal that Elon Musk tweeted out after he returned back from visiting Ukraine. I guess it was about a year ago. And again, he was excoriated, eviscerated. He was attacked by people in the media, by the Ukrainian government, by the European Union and everybody who is invested in this war came against Elon Musk for daring to call for peace in this tweet. And we looked at the first issue that he raised about the elections, and we talked about last week that, or on Monday, that that everyone was criticizing the elections and saying the elections weren't fair because the Russians were in Crimea and that the Russians were rigging the elections in the Donbass and stuffing ballot boxes and all the stuff that the Democrats do here. They're accusing Russia of doing that in the Donbass. So Elon Musk says, well, if that's the case, let's do the elections over again. I mean, let's have a real plan for peace. Do the elections over again and see what the people want. And I explained to you that the people wanted to separate from Ukraine. They did not trust Ukraine. And the reason they didn't trust Ukraine is because Ukraine had been acting so hostile to them in many, many ways. And I started to explain that in the last podcast. I'm going to go into some more ways that the Nazi government that the United States put in power, the interim government before Ukraine had elections, the Nazis that we were controlling were acting very hostile towards the people in these provinces in the eastern part of Ukraine that bordered Russia. They were mostly Russian-speaking Ukrainians, and they were called terrorists by the Nazis. The Nazis called them terrorists, and they went to war with them. So the elections in Crimea were the first. Crimea, and that's what I was explaining in the last podcast, that Crimea moved quickly after the coup. They were the first to have elections. They were the first to separate. They were the first to be annexed. So the other regions that wanted to separate and follow Ukraine's lead, they started to move after or follow Crimea's lead. They started to move after Crimea. This second proposal in Elon Musk's peace proposal here, or peace plan, is, I mean, he really didn't need to add it. It's kind of redundant to the first issue, because if they have the elections again in Crimea and the UN supervised it and Crimea voted to be part of Ukraine, then this, you don't really need this second one. So there's really only three of them here. Assure the water supply. We explained that in the last podcast, how the Nazis, that they dammed the canal from the fresh water coming into Crimea after Crimea voted to join Russia. These are people that are trying to fight to repatriate these people in Crimea, but you're cutting off water and making them suffer. These are the kind of hostile moves that these Nazis were making, and why these people wanted to separate. So after the vote and the annexation of Crimea, Donbass moves to separate next. And Donbass are the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, and they held their referendum in May. Again, timeline here, the coup happens in late February. In late March, Crimea votes to separate and is annexed late March. And then so you have April, and then early May is when the referendum in the Donbass, where they hold the vote. This is a clip about the referendum in the Donbass. Take a listen.
This is the man who would be leader of a new republic in the east of Ukraine, the Donetsk People's Republic.
Oh, yeah. And that's what they once, that's what they called it. They called it the Donetsk People's Republic after, and I think they had a Luhansk People's Republic as well. They called themselves a republic after they voted for their independence.
Borders redrawn in marker pen, huge chunks of the south and eastern Ukraine enveloped by Russia.
They were trying to tell us that Russia is the occupier, but we know it's not like that. We are one people, and the borders should be open. They're already sufficiently open in the rest of Europe, and I think in the nearest future there will be some kind of union here.
And outside his office in the occupied local administration building in Donetsk, the few people milling about among armed men in balaclavas were pleased with the referendum result.
The newly formed republic will be built as a free republic, free from the Kiev junta.
We want to be under Putin's power. We want to join and live together because our children keep dying.
So you see, the people, many of the people want it to be joined with Russia. They want it to separate again. So the Nazi government coming in and trying to repatriate them and going to war with them, you're going to see they just wanted to dehumanize these people. And they did dehumanize these people, as you're going
to
see.
By pro-Russian fighters, blockaded by forces loyal to Kiev, the idea of separation has taken root amid the violence.
So listen to that part. The idea of separation has taken root amongst the violence. All right. Now, just hold on to that. Let me show you something.
Fighters blockaded by forces loyal to Kiev. The idea of separation has taken root amid the violence.
So the idea of separation has taken root amidst the violence. So what he's talking about there in, when he's saying that is that at first, after the coup, the people of Donetsk and Luhansk, they didn't necessarily want to separate right after the coup. The coup isn't what made them want to separate. It was the violence after the coup that made them want to separate. Take a look at this. This says, while early polls in April reported that supporters of independence were a small minority, just like I was explaining to you about when we got involved in World War II, if you would have taken polls before Pearl Harbor, 90% of Americans didn't want us to get involved in World War II. After Pearl Harbor, those numbers flipped. That Pearl Harbor made Americans want us to get into the war. So this is this Wikipedia page, and this is the source right here from the LA Times. While early polls in April, this is in April, they don't have the referendum until May. While early polls in April reported that supporters of independence were a small minority, the LA Times reported that the later violence in Odessa and Mariupol turned many against the Ukrainian transitional government, that it was the violence that turned people in the Donetsk and Luhansk region against the government. And that's why the polls shift and most people wanted to separate after the violence in Odessa and in Mariupol. In Odessa and Mariupol. I showed you guys what happened in Odessa that made these people turn against the traditional government. I showed you that in the last podcast, a little bit of that. I at least showed you the Odessa massacre, how they burned people alive. And I explained to you how if Crimea wouldn't have moved quickly to bring the Russians in for protection and to separate, that what happened in Odessa would have most certainly happened in Crimea. But what happened in Mariupol? Show you guys what happened in Mariupol. We'll watch this in just a moment. Before we watch what happened in Mariupol, this was the Oscars. And just, I guess it was like 2 weeks ago. And the documentary feature film was this filmmaker that made this movie called 20 Days in Mariupol. And the 20 days that he documents in this movie, and you can watch the movie. It's a PBS movie. You can watch it on YouTube. I thought I had it. Anyway, it's right here. I'll show you here in a moment. So I just want you to listen to a little bit of his speech at the Oscars, the 20 days in Mariupol that he documents here in this PBS documentary, and he wins this Oscar for. Is the 20 days after Russia invaded Mariupol. But I'm going to show you what happened in 2014 in Mariupol. And I wonder why this guy didn't make a movie about that. And if he did, why didn't he win an Oscar about what I'm getting ready to show you, which happened in 2014. But listen to a little bit of his speech here at the Oscars 2 weeks ago.
And the Oscar goes to 20 Days in Mariupol.
This is the first Oscar win and nomination from Mislav Chernev.
Thank you, AP, Frontline, and GBH. Evgeny, Vasilisa, Michelle, Rainey, Daryl. Thank you for making this film with me. Thank you for helping me in this journey. This is the first Oscar in the Ukrainian history. And I'm honored. But probably I will be the first director on this stage who will say, I wish I would never made this film. I wish to be able to exchange this to Russia never attacking Ukraine, never occupying our cities.
Yeah, I wish that too. I wish that Russia would have never had to invade Mariupol. I wish that would have happened. If you guys want to watch this documentary again, you can watch it on YouTube. I'm not going to show you any of that. I want to show you what happened in Mariupol in 2014.
For 3 days in a row, the Ukrainian National Guard and police special forces have been showing their strength in the center of the southern city of Mariupol. Today, they told us the central police station was being taken over by pro-Russian
separatists. See, and the thing is,
substantial force was being mustered.
The thing is that I really resent. This is what I resent, is that these people want to make you believe that the war in Mariupol started in 2022. That's what they want you to believe. That's what the Biden administration wants you to believe. That's what the EU wants you to believe. They want you to believe that all of this started in 2022 when Russia invaded. And I'm telling you, there was war in Odessa in 2014. There was war in Crimea in 2014. There was war in Mariupol in 2014. There was war in Donbas region in 2014. The war didn't just start in 2022 when Russia rolled in. And Russia, as I'm getting ready to show you, Russia did everything to negotiate, make the invasion unnecessary. That Russia attempted to negotiate. They wanted to negotiate from the beginning of the invasion. Biden refused to negotiate. Russia at every point, I'm going to show you that they attempted to stop this war before they invaded. The war did not start in 2022. It started in 2014. The war in Mariupol, why do you want to only focus on the 20 days? 20 days in Mariupol. Why don't you focus on the last 10 years in Mariupol?
To resist. They did not want the arsenal of weapons being stored inside to fall into the hands of their opponents. Volleys of gunfire were being traded in residential streets, civilians running desperately for safety. Attempts to move through the streets were stopped by sheer weight of fire. This was no skirmish going on. This piece of video shows armored vehicles and then a soldier firing a rocket-propelled grenade. People were being hit, some of them civilians caught in crossfire. We found a man being carried away in a car. Another man was then hit and wounded just a few meters away. As they help a third victim, the sound you're about to hear was the crack of a bullet passing overhead. Little wonder they ran.
All right, so this is, this this is 2014 Mariupol. Mariupol is right down here. I'll show you. This is Mariupol. No, where is Mariupol? Right here. This is Mariupol. So it's just south of the Donetsk region, right on the border with Ukraine. With Russia. And that's what happened in 2014. So the violence, this is what this, going back to this Wikipedia page, while early polls in April, they did polls in April. April's after the coup, so the Nazi government is in power and is taking control of the government. The truth of the matter is that a lot of these people didn't like Yanukovych, and they were happy that Yanukovych was gone, and they were hoping that they got a government that would work with them, that would accept them. They didn't expect to get a Nazi government that would try to outlaw the Russian language and immediately go to war with them. But while early polls in April reported that supporters of independence were a small minority, the LA Times reported that the later violence in Odessa and Mariupol turned many in the Donetsk and Luhansk, the Donbas region, against the Ukrainian traditional government. So they have the referendum in May. I want you to take a look at this clip. This is a little bit about the day that they have the referendum there.
Sort of this vote has been branded illegal by the Ukrainian government and its Western allies. There's no independent observers monitoring this referendum.
Yeah, there's no independent observers because the UN was already in cahoots with Victoria Nuland, according to the phone call. So, of course, the UN's not going to come in. So no observers here.
Спасибо.
And this goes back to, so if there's no observers and you're saying that, watch, sorry, hold on.
Sort of this vote has been branded illegal by the Ukrainian government and its Western allies. There's no independent observers monitoring this referendum. And yesterday, 100,000 already ticked yes voted ballots were discovered by the Ukrainian security services. So
he's saying that the Ukrainian security services, they found a bunch of ballots like the Democrats do that were already that they were already voted yes, and they found a stash of ballots. So they're saying there's no observers here. We're finding, you know, boxes of ballots like the Democrats do. And so this wasn't a fair election. Okay, it wasn't fair. Back to Elon Musk's proposal. Where is it at? Back to Elon Musk's peace proposal. Let's do it again if they weren't fair. Let's see what the people of the Donbas region want. Let's see if they want to, under the UN supervision, bring in all the observers you want. Let's redo the elections, like Elon Musk said. No, they didn't want to do that.
People here expect this to be a bit of a foregone conclusion in terms of the result. The OSCE and no independent monitors are here to monitor this election. Instead, the Donetsk People's Republic have chosen a group of ladies sat here monitoring this polling booth. Not sure how effective that'll be. From the looks of it, most of the votes that have been cast here today, at least, are a resounding yes. Svetlana, can you tell me why you're coming down here to vote today?
Yes, сегодня в городе Донецке я нахожусь. Я пришла на избирательный участок, чтобы проголосовать за республику, за Донецкую свободную республику. Мы люди русские. Мы пришли поддержать себя. Мы против войны. Мы против боевиков.
So people are voting. I mean, this is a Vice report again. Of course, they have a bias. But you see the people there voting, and if you don't trust the results in the elections, like Elon Musk says, do the elections over again. But the referendum did pass in May, on May 11th, 2014. Again, Russia does not annex this region until September of 2022, 8 years later. Now, I explained to you in the last podcast that after Crimea voted for their independence, and the referendum was over and it was overwhelmingly for independence, the people of Crimea sent a delegation to Moscow to meet with Vladimir Putin to request that Vladimir Putin annex them. When the Donbas region did their referendum in 2014, they also sent a delegation to Moscow to meet with Vladimir Putin to request that Vladimir Putin annex them. Now, in the case of Crimea, because of the strategic location on the Black Sea and the naval base in Sevastopol, and the fact that that Putin and most Russians believed that it was a mistake by Khrushchev to give Crimea to Ukraine, Russia immediately annexes Crimea. But if you remember the interview, and I don't have it queued, but the interview that Tucker Carlson does with Vladimir Putin, where Vladimir Putin says, you know, why did they stage this coup? Why did they do all this stuff this way? You know, we would have never moved in Crimea. They could have kept Crimea if they wouldn't have done things this way. We were never thinking about taking Crimea. But after they staged the coup, after these Nazis start to act hostile to the Russian-speaking people, and then the people of Crimea move to separate, of course, he annexes them right away. The people of the Donbas region, when they send that delegation to Moscow to meet with Putin in 2014, he doesn't annex them right away. Why? Why doesn't he annex them in 2014? Well, back to thinking about Texas. Why didn't the United States annex Texas immediately after Texas won its independence from Mexico? Well, the reason that the United States did not annex Texas immediately is because the United States was not in a position to start a war with Mexico. And they did not want to harm diplomatic relations with Mexico by immediately annexing Texas. And although Russia had annexed Crimea, they did not want to exacerbate the tensions by also annexing the Donbas region, because Vladimir Putin still wanted to negotiate a peaceful settlement. That's what the Minsk agreements were. That the Minsk Accords happened in 2014. Immediately, Russia entered into negotiations with the new government there in Kiev. It was being mediated by France and Germany. Look what it says here. The Minsk agreements were a series of international agreements which sought to end the Donbas war fought between armed Russian separatist groups and armed forces of Ukraine that were being armed by the United States or the CIA. So let me just say that. Not the United States, CIA. They were not being armed overboard, but underboard with Russia regular forces. Playing a central part. But hey, check out this Wikipedia page. It doesn't talk about the central intelligence playing a central part as well. The first known as the Minsk Protocols was drafted in 2014 by the Trilateral Contact Group of Ukraine, consisting of Ukraine, Russia, and the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, with the mediation by the leaders of France and Germany. So France and Germany put this all together. Immediately, Russia starts to negotiate and tried to negotiate peace, not only peace in the Donbas and a ceasefire, but also negotiating to get this water returned to Crimea. You know, this I showed you in the last podcast the clip of the guy from Crimea saying that we're willing to pay. We've drawn up agreements. Well, this was also being negotiated in Minsk, that we're willing to pay you for the water. Just remove the dam. We want to stop the war. How can we stop the war? Russia starts to negotiate immediately in the Minsk accords, the Minsk protocol. So that is why Russia did not want to annex the Donbass region immediately, because it would have ruined the negotiations. Says here, after the extensive talks in Minsk, Belarus, an agreement was signed on the 5th of September 2014 by representatives of the trilateral contact group, and without recognition of their status by then leaders of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic and Luhansk People's Republic. This agreement followed multiple previous attempts to stop the fighting in the region and aim to implement an immediate ceasefire. So Russia's negotiating on behalf of these people. When the delegation comes from Donbass to ask for annexation, Russia tells them, no, we're not going to annex you, but we're going to support you in your fight for independence, and we're going to give you weapons and train you. We're even going to send some fighters to fight with you, but we're not going to annex you. And then we're going to go and attempt to negotiate a peaceful settlement. So that's what Russia is doing immediately. I don't see the Obama administration in this. I don't see Obama trying to negotiate peace at all. There, I see the Obama administration attempting to escalate the war more. And then when Trump comes in 2016, like I told you, that's what Russiagate and everything was about, to tie his hands, to force him to also to act hostile towards these people and support the government. By that time, I don't think Trump was really even aware of all this stuff and what was going on there. By that time, they had elections. Poroshenko was, you know, fairly elected. I think that, and then Zelensky had just gotten elected at the same time that Trump was coming in. Anyway, so like I was telling you, I've told you, is that the election of Poroshenko legitimized the coup d'etat. So they had to get that election going as soon as possible, which they did. Let's read here a little bit more about the Minsk agreements, because the first Minsk agreement that they had signed in September of 2014 failed. It says right here, the agreement failed to stop the fighting. So even though we're negotiating this peace agreement and a ceasefire, the fighting doesn't stop. And it was thus followed up by a revised agreement, and that's called the Minsk II agreements, which was signed on the 12th of February, 2015. This agreement consisted of a package of measures, including a ceasefire, a withdrawal of heavy weapons from the front line, and release of prisoners. So Minsk II failed as well, essentially. And there's a reason why Minsk failed. And the reason why it failed is because, I can't believe this happened, that this woman said this, told us why Minsk failed. But the Chancellor of Germany, who was negotiating the Minsk agreements at that time, was Angela Merkel. And it's funny, because Angela Merkel, this whole time, she's one of the biggest customers of Vladimir Putin for his natural gas. She's the biggest customer for his natural gas at this time, where all this is going on. So she's negotiating in Minsk and trying to, you know, reach this peaceful settlement, you know, appearing to, while she's buying the Russian natural gas. It's, remember when Trump went over there, he's like, you guys are, this is all some show. You know, you're trying to act hostile to Russia, but you're buying his gas. You're his biggest customers. They would still be buying Russian gas if Joe Biden wouldn't have blown up the Nord Stream pipeline. But Angela Merkel, who was negotiating at the same time she's buying all that sweet Russian gas at a cheap price, then she comes out and she says, look, what it says right here, former German Chancellor Merkel admits that the Minsk agreement was merely to buy time for Ukraine's armies to build up. That's why Minsk didn't work. She tells you, she says it, she admits it, that we were only pretending to negotiate with Putin. We never intended for a ceasefire. We never intended to live by the Minsk agreements, that the Minsk agreements were merely to buy time for Ukraine's army to build up for war. Wow. Well, I'm almost done here. I want to focus real quick on this last issue here on Elon Musk's peace proposal that he tweeted out, and he deleted this because he got so much heat for it. But it was a poll, and he put it out about a year ago. And again, he was excoriated, eviscerated for putting this out. And this last issue, Ukraine remains neutral. What is this about? Well, take a listen to this clip. This is what Ukraine Remains Neutral is about.
First things first, what is NATO? The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a security alliance between North America and Europe. It was formed after the Second World War. The goal, they say, was to protect democratic freedom. On the 4th of April 1949, the North Atlantic Treaty was signed. This treaty was simply an anti-Soviet accord aimed at countering any future aggression by the USSR.
Anti-Soviet, not anti-Russia, anti-Soviet.
It established a new balance of power in Europe. It promised all members collective security. That's a core principle laid out in Article 5 of the NATO Treaty. It obliges member states to protect each other in case of a war. It says an armed attack against one ally will be an attack on all allies, meaning if one NATO nation is attacked, all NATO nations will retaliate. This allowed NATO members to pool and share their military resources. They built efficient defense capabilities, but there was more to NATO than just defense. It was an alliance of liberal countries, an engine of democratization that was supposed to promote common values and interests, also push back against the rise of communism. Naturally, Moscow saw this alliance as a threat to its interests. In response, it created the Warsaw Pact in the year 1955. It was a counterweight to NATO, the Warsaw Pact. These were the members. Their goal was the same. If one Warsaw Pact member is attacked, all others will defend it. In Russian historical memory, there were five reasons why such a pact was justified, five major invasions when the West threatened Russian interests. This includes the Polish occupation of the Kremlin in early 17th century, the Swedish invasion of Russia in early 18th century, the Napoleon invasion of the 19th century, and the two wars with Germany in the 20th century. In each case, the very essence of the Russian state was threatened. So suspicion and fear of the West took deep roots in Russia. Moscow began perceiving NATO as a tool of American imperialism. And the assessment was not really off the mark. In 1989, the Berlin Wall collapsed. In 1991, the Soviet Union disintegrated and the Iron Curtain was completely demolished. Europe's regional order hinged on one question. Should Germany align itself with the US and NATO, or should it join the Russians through the Warsaw Pact?
So understand that this was the huge question. It came down to Germany. Now, if you remember, if you know your history, that Adolf Hitler, he at first made a pact with Stalin, then he stabbed Stalin in the back and invaded Russia, and then Russia became enemies with Germany and began to fight Germany and the Nazis from the east. At the same time, when the United States gets into World War II, they begin to fight Germany from the west. The Russians actually get into Berlin first. They come from the east when the war is ending and supposedly Hitler and Eva commit suicide, if you believe that. The Russians get in first and the Americans come in and then they put up the wall. And the wall is there until the 1980s when the Soviet Union is defeated. You remember Ronald Reagan tear down this wall, and then Germany is one Germany again. At this time, you have NATO basically representing the West, and then the Warsaw Pact representing the East. And the question becomes, is Germany, now that Germany is one Germany, the wall has come down, is Germany going to be part of the Warsaw Pact, or is Germany going to be part of NATO? That was the question.
Germany align itself with the U.S. and NATO, or should it join the Russians through the Warsaw Pact? The U.S. government, under George H.W. Bush, made an offer.
Under who? Under George H.W. Bush. This man was your enemy. I'm going to talk more about George H.W. Bush and his family probably in the next podcast. I'm going to be wrapping up talking about Ukraine, and I'll just probably keep you posted on things as they happen moving forward. But I have some things I'm going to share to wrap this up in the next podcast. And I'm going to be talking about
the U.S.
George
H. Today, the U.S. was not really off the mark.
I'm going to be talking about George H.W. Bush and his friends and family.
The U.S. government, under George H.W. Bush, made an offer to Russian President Mikhail Gorbachev. It suggested if Germany became a NATO member, NATO would stop expanding, not one inch eastwards.
You hear this?
No new members.
This is what George H.W. Bush told Gorbachev, that if you allow us to accept Germany into NATO, that NATO will not move one inch past Germany. Not one other country east of Germany will we move if you allow Germany to be part of NATO, is what George H.W. Bush told Gorbachev.
Expanding, not one inch eastwards. No new members. Today, the U.S. says it made no such promise, that no such deal was ever struck, but hundreds of memos, meeting minutes, and transcripts from U.S. archives indicate otherwise.
Listen to what she's saying, that the United States now says that, oh, we never made that deal. But it's in the minutes. It's in the notes. There's tons of evidence. She says hundreds of pieces of evidence that, yes, in fact, George H.W. Bush, you did make this deal.
Such deal was ever struck, but hundreds of memos, meeting minutes, and transcripts from U.S. archives indicate otherwise. Nevertheless, Moscow bought the offer. It demolished the Warsaw Pact in the hope that the West would follow suit, that NATO, too, would be dissolved. But that never happened. NATO refused to cease operations. And to add insult to injury, they kept the door for membership open. Russia saw it as a stab in the back, and NATO kept pushing the dagger deeper. Look at this map. NATO started out with 12 founding members, but since the Soviet Union fell, it has radically expanded eastwards. In 1999, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic joined NATO. In 2004, there was another wave of expansion. 7 Central and Eastern European nations were made NATO members. Some of them were former Soviet republics. In 2009, Albania and Croatia joined NATO. And the most recent entries were Montenegro and North Macedonia, both situated in Russia's backyard. It does
actually
not
the most
there.
Recent entry, because this report was done before Sweden just joined recently. So, this is what's going on.
As of 2021, NATO officially recognized 3 more aspiring members: Bosnia and Herzegovina, Georgia, and Ukraine. Last we checked, NATO was also in talks with Sweden, Finland, and Serbia for membership. So to put it simply,
so they've already accepted Sweden. Ukraine is not a member, and that is what Elon Musk is talking about in this final issue here of his peace proposal, that Ukraine remains neutral. And And they didn't like this. They didn't like any of this. So they didn't want to negotiate a peace agreement really in Minsk. According to Angela Merkel, that was all a ploy to build up their arms against Russia. And just like the Nazi government in 2014 began to behave very hostile with the Russian-speaking people in eastern part of Ukraine and basically driving them into the hands of Russia, the West is acting very hostile towards Russia and has been for a long period of time. We're on the verge of something very, very dark if we do not turn and force our leaders to negotiate peace. Not another dime for war. There shouldn't be another dime giving to Ukraine for war. We should be not only demanding that there is peace negotiations, we should be encouraging, we should be mediating it and facilitating a peace talk between the Ukrainian government and Russia to bring this war to an end. Nothing more than that should be acceptable. And I won't accept any more than that. I don't think that they should, especially when you're looking at our debt, especially when you're looking at our debt and our border and our budget. And our deficits and all of the issues that we're dealing with in this country. When you consider all that, there's no way we should give another dime to put more gas on this fire, because that's going to only increase the potential that we're going to have to spend more, not only in money, in blood, later because of this stupid war. All right, folks. I will be back on Monday, and like I said, I have a few more things that I want to talk about with Ukraine and what's really going on, and should wrap that up, and then we'll see you guys next week. I hope you have a great weekend.